Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Unsurprisingly, this morning we are going to talk about the executive orders that President Donald Trump has signed the shortest period of time. And in his first day in office, he signed more than any executive orders on such a day as his predecessors. He signed 26, and by the 23rd of January, he'd signed another 4. So he's off and swinging. The topics have covered everything from trade policy, border security, birthright citizenship, cancelling diversity, equity, and inclusion in federal government and agencies, and more besides. And I thought it would be quite intriguing to get the take from our resident expert on all things American, my colleague, Nicholas Lorimer. Nicholas, hi.
Hi. Right. So the sort of gambit of these things ranges from pretty much inconsequential to pretty important. Quite a few of these executive orders Trump issued were things that he actually did last time when he became president, similar executive orders. And a couple of these things have been kind of ping-ponging around. When a Democrat gets in, they repeal a bunch of these executive orders and then replace them with their own ones, and vice versa when a Republican gets in. The thing I do want to make...
I mean, I guess there's quite a few of quite a number of Joe Biden's executive orders in one executive order.
Yes, energy policy and stuff. That's often that seems to be one of the areas where there's been a lot of sort of whiplash from one to the other. And this is a emerging trend in American politics over the past couple of decades, is that because Congress seems less and less capable of passing legislation, and because presidents have become more and more powerful, increasingly what happens is you get a president who comes in and he passes a whole bunch of these executive orders, which only last as long as the president is in power. It's not clear, and quite often a lot of them get shot down at the courts because the U.S. system is not supposed to run like this. The president's actually not supposed to run things. So it's been growing steadily. Every single presidency, more and more executive orders get issued. Biden did a huge number, and now Trump, I think, as you said at the beginning, has topped the charts in the most number of executive orders ever in his second term. Some of them are the controversial but ultimately not very important renaming of the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America, which I think is largely a sort of the kind of thing that people who support Trump very strongly will love, and people who hate him will really hate, and then they can spend all their time fighting in the media about what to call it, even though it doesn't really matter. Some of it was, as you said, ending diversity, inclusion, equity programs in the federal government, which I think is probably quite a good idea. These programs have not been terribly good at fixing some of the inequalities in America's in the United States, and they really haven't improved race relations, gender relations, or really any of these other issues.
Can I just stop you on that one?
Go ahead.
Just to look at the sort of consequences, because it's almost, I mean, it might be a bit hyperbolic to say, but it's almost at the stroke of a pen, he's dispatched DEI personally into the ether that it deserves to be, because I see the large sort of policies and ideas that come out of it actually are not beneficial to society. If anything, they are largely an anathema to much of what society needs to run. So just sort of by the by, do you think that this helps to hasten the relegation of DEI generally in America and possibly even in the Anglosphere?
It's an interesting question, actually. I think that this is actually, in a sense, the culmination of a trend that's been building for a while. These diversity, equity, inclusion programs really hit their stride actually at the very end of the first Trump administration in 2020, with the Black Lives Matter protests and the killing of George Floyd. that I think kind of created a big cultural overreach by the proponents of these policies. Mm. And they were sort of enacted all over the place in American culture, but also all around the world, particularly in the corporate sphere, but also in government. And they've been building for a while these ideological programs from the sort of early 2010s. And there was a big pushback. And this is, in a sense, I think the culmination of that pushback. It was a pushback that started with a Supreme Court ruling that said that race can't be taken into consideration in the U.S. For university admissions. A lot of corporations slowly over the last couple of years canning their DEI departments and slowly sort of scaling them back. And now Trump eliminating it from the federal government, I think, is basically the sort of, as I said, the culmination of that whole thing. So I think I would say that this is probably in some ways he's swimming with the cultural tide here, and that's why I think it's probably going to be quite an effective one. Now it remains to be seen whether this will cause a backlash in the other direction again. We seem to be in quite unstable times, so who knows? I think the first Trump administration did have something to do with the acceleration of these DEI programs throughout the U.S. because the opposition to Trump sort of galvanized a sort of the left in America very aggressively. And so maybe the same thing will happen again, or maybe, you know, there is a genuine cultural shift here and people are moving back towards merit-based appointments. Remains to be seen.
Do executive orders, unless they're overturned by the courts or until they're overturned by the next president, do they effectively have the same force of law as legislation would coming out the House and the Senate?
They do basically have the force of law, which is one of the reasons why they're controversial as a concept in of themselves, is that this is essentially the executive branch, which is not supposed to make laws, of legislating. And now this is supposed to be for emergencies really more than anything else, but the use and the creative use of executive orders, as I was saying at the when I started, it has massively expanded over the past couple of decades. In Bush, Biden, Bush, Obama, Trump, and Biden administrations, there's been a lot of use of these. Some of the other important ones, there's a lot of stuff to do with the U.S. border. It's not clear how much of these are genuinely full-on policy changes. Some of them are policy changes, like getting people to remain in Mexico rather than taking them into the U.S. There's leaving the Paris Climate Accord, which Trump did at the beginning of his first administration. So it's not particularly unexpected. There's some stuff on energy, moving the U.S. in a more fossil fuels direction rather than a more renewables direction. In terms of the most controversial, I would say, there's two. And the first one is executive order granting pardons for all of the people convicted of offenses related to the riot and attack on the U.S. Capitol on the 6th of January, 2021, when supporters of Trump basically wanted to intimidate Vice President Mike Pence into throwing out the results of the presidential election and declaring that it was fraudulent, and therefore open up a debate as to whether Joe Biden had won the election. That failed, ultimately, but not before some of these supporters had broken their way into the Capitol building and caused the legislators to flee. Some of the people filmed during that day were convicted in various courts on charges ranging from trespassing to assault. There were several people killed, including one of the protesters who was shot as she climbed in through a window, but also police officers who were very badly injured in the fighting. This is pretty controversial because essentially this was a mob acting. Largely not, there's debate as to how much it was under Trump's direction, but essentially in his favor, that has been let off of their convictions. There were some cases where the people were not granted full pardons. The most, I think it was the 14 most violent and harsh sentences. For example, the leader of the the militia, the Proud Boys, had his sentence mm-hmm. commuted rather than pardoned. So this was something that Trump promised during the election campaign. He was not shy about saying that he was definitely going to do this. And I do think that there are some people who spoke in favor of Trump who very much claimed that you couldn't take his promises seriously and that he didn't really mean it. I think those people should perhaps reconsider as to, you know, maybe you should take Trump more seriously when he says he's going to do something. And I think that's also why a lot of his supporters like him, is precisely because I think particularly in this administration, he seems to be following through on his promises. Whether that's a good thing or not is debatable. The other one that's actually quite controversial but hasn't gotten nearly as much attention is the delaying the TikTok ban for 75 days. Mm-hmm. So both houses of Congress passed a law with a veto-proof majority, so that is more than two-thirds majority, saying that TikTok needed to either sell its American operations to an American company or it would be banned from all app stores in the country, and no American company phone would be allowed to update the app or install it. Before becoming president, Trump effectively undid this ban without actually the force of law. He basically tweeted out or posted on Truth Social that he would prevent the prosecution of any company that didn't comply with the ban, and that he thought there needed to be an extension to this negotiation so that a deal could be worked out of some sort that would allow TikTok to remain legal. The reason it's controversial is because, firstly, he essentially managed to get some compliance from some companies before he even became president or issued the actual law, even though this is the executive order, even though this is in complete contravention of the law that was written. But furthermore, the law does allow for an extension of the deadline at to which TikTok was supposed to be banned. TikTok's ban came into force one day before the inauguration of Trump. But there are very strict requirements for the extension of said TikTok's legality, and they include basically making a case to Congress of a detailed sale that is in progress, and therefore is going to, you know, there's a reasonable chance that it's going to conclude and go ahead. So that's why they need the extension. There doesn't appear to be any sale in progress. Trump has proposed a deal, saying that an American company would own 50% of it or something like that. But it's not clear whether that's actually moving forward in any serious direction. So effectively, what Trump did was create a sort of a gray area. On one hand, the Senate Intelligence Committee, which is run by Republicans at the moment, said that it was his extension was illegal and that it actually couldn't come into force, whereas he's saying that his Department of Justice will not enforce any sanctions on companies that are breaking the law in this. So some companies have complied, but a lot of them, I believe, have kind of decided that they're not going to host TikTok on their app store. So I think that there's a big court fight probably coming down the line, and that this was probably quite a bit of overreach from the executive department, which is why I think that this has a lot of potential to be quite a serious issue. He essentially sort of went around a very solidly passed law in Congress that was also confirmed to be a legal law by the Supreme Court, which actually ruled on the TikTok ban just prior to it going into effect, saying that this law comported with the First Amendment and was not in violation of the Constitution. So that's a fight I think that's coming down the line, perhaps. I think a lot of people to see how the ban goes, whether it gets extended again, which would be complete contradiction of the law. There'd be no wiggle room there, or whether something gets worked out.
Well, that's quite interesting because the Supreme Court has a majority of Republican nominated judges sitting on it. So it does set up a very, very interesting tension.
Which hurts the sort of claim that this is, you know, an obstructionist court just shooting down a Republican president's ideas, which is, I think, an argument that might be dug out if the TikTok extension is overturned.
Right. And anything else that sort of is on the side of the positive before we look at possibly the really negative?
Yeah, I think there's a bunch of things where we don't really know whether they're going to be good or not yet. There's the creation of the Department of Government Efficiency, which is being headed by Elon Musk. It remains to be seen how effective that's going to be. The U.S. government is spending a lot of money and does definitely have some serious inefficiencies in it. So it does need effective restructuring, I think, in some places. It's possible that either there's two ways that this could go wrong, though. On one hand, this could become a very partisan political tool where people are just purged from the government because they don't align with a certain party's politics. Or it could end up becoming just a sort of committee that produces a report that no one really reads about and then fades or reads through and then wants to truly make a positive impact needs to avoid, even though it's probably quite necessary to do this. There's also the deployment of additional resources to the U.S. southern border. That border has a big problem with a lot of people who are abusing the asylum process, are using that to come across into the U.S. There's also, of course, significant amounts of drug smuggling that goes on through that southern border, which has been a very contentious issue within the U.S. It's not clear yet how much this will be able to reduce some of these problems. One of the big problems with regards to the asylum law is that ultimately the big issue here, the legislation needs to be changed in order to truly solve the problem. And Congress does not seem to be in any particular mood to actually make a change here. And so any attempt to try and fix some of the asylum problems and the loopholes in that system, I think currently are going to struggle. The president probably doesn't have the power to actually effectively solve that problem. And unless he can organize some sort of changing of the legislation in Congress, which the president does have a lot of authority to do. Trump has huge sway over the Republican Party, but he would also need support from at least some Democrats to do that. So that's, I think, a challenge, but one that there is potential scope for, because I think a lot of Democrats have realized that the issue of immigration is really hurting their electoral chances. So I think that'll be a feature of the next couple of years as well. Is debates over immigration are going to come really to the fore. Also, as Trump begins deporting significant numbers of illegal aliens, which he promised to do during the election campaign.
I see that the president of Colombia accepted some deportees from Colombia, but only after he and Trump had an argument over the fact that they were transported in military airplanes rather than a civilian. They damaged their dignity or something to that effect. So this should throw up some interesting experiences, shall we say.
Yeah, it was a very sort of modern political dispute in that the whole thing was kind of carried out on social media. The social media posts were essentially setting policy. Trump says, we're putting all these tariffs on Colombia because, they, as you say, they won't accept deportees from the United States on military planes. And the president of Colombia hits back and says, we're going to retaliate with tariffs. You can't bully us. We need to dignify people. And I think the conclusion they've decided to reach was that the Colombians would use their resources to transport people so that they could make sure that their citizens were being deported in dignity, I think. And that they all, in the end, decided they weren't going to tariff each other, probably. But, it really felt like a sort of random shouting match that just started in a public space between, two presidents of two sovereign nations.
Right. And other noteworthy, for good or bad reasons, other executive orders that we should either watch out for or just be totally amazed by?
This one sort of caught my eye. I really don't know what to make of it. The Promoting Beautiful Federal Civic Architecture, which is an executive order which creates revisions to how federal buildings are going to be built around the U.S. So depending on what that produces, we may see truly wonderful, magnificent pieces of architecture or absolutely hideous blocks of concrete. I'm going to be interested to watch that one. As someone who has been to D.C. a couple of times and is quite a big fan of that city, I hope that positive changes are made rather than negative ones.
Okay, the man is an aesthete of sorts.
I wish.
And from a point of foreign policy in particular, anything significant on that score unrelated to the border?
I think it's a little bit difficult to say. The Trump foreign policy as it stands right now, I think everyone's still trying to get to grips with what it is, or if it exists, or rather whether it's just a sort of, you know, kind of make it up as you go along type of thing. So there was an executive order called Putting America and Its Interests First in Foreign Policy, was the title, and it said that every decision made on foreign policy needs to take into account the national interest of the United States. But whether that actually means anything in practice, you know, it's kind of like putting out an executive order saying, I hereby order the government to only do things that are good for us and things and not things that are bad for us, which, you know, there's a lot of scope for debate in every single action you could take. And you could say that, you could make any argument to say that what the US is doing here or there is in its interest or not in its interest. But so far, there's an awful lot of willingness to use tariffs as a negotiation tool.
Just perhaps finally is to look at issues that seem that have a sort of relationship, and that is withdrawing from the Paris Climate Agreement and going back into fossil fuel production. And I forget the term he used, but he ushered it in with a great deal of enthusiasm that I suppose things like fracking and oil exploration are back on the table, which they were very much off the table under the Biden administration for climate change purposes.
Yes. So I think this is also some of the more impactful stuff in those executive orders is the change to energy policy. This is the sort of stuff that will, I think, irritate some of the competitors in this space. Because obviously Trump, I think, is very focused on fuel costs in the US, which often have a very big political salience. It's something that people watch as an indication of whether the country is going well or not, is how cheap fuel is there. Americans are addicted to or used to cheap fuel, being a significant oil producer. So that's kind of what Trump's going at here. He also has a interesting and long recorded hatred of what he calls windmills or wind turbines, which he has had a vendetta against ever since, I think, some were built near one of his golf courses in Scotland. And he's kind of been a big opponent of them ever since. But this is this may hurt Russia quite significantly. Russia is running into financial problems now related to the war in Ukraine, its invasion of Ukraine. And it's needing to sell its oil at sort of discounted prices, especially to India, but also to China. And depressing the oil price globally would also probably reduce Russia's ability to pay itself there. Also probably hurt Iran to some degree, who similarly also depends a lot on the export of oil and fossil fuels. One of those things that it remains to be seen, because of course, you know, there's a lot more that goes into this. It's not just federal energy policy. The private sector also is responding to various market incentives and you know, waves in the global market can have more of an impact on this than any particular policy. But I think this in the short term definitely is probably going to help the US to put pressure on some of its foreign opponents.
Well, perhaps the as I understand it, that China produces most of the world's windmills, so turbines.
Yes, this is another reason that the geopolitics comes into it is China produces a lot of renewable equipment, and so is very keen for other countries around the world, particularly the United States, to adopt them, hoping that if there's ever conflict between the two, they can cut off the supply.
Yeah.
China also has to import almost all of its oil and fossil fuels because it doesn't really have supplies of them itself.
So basically, it's going to be the art of the deal is going to be the theme of the Trump administration, and will give us lots of subject matter to talk around. Nick, thank you very much for coming on, and I'm sure we will explore some of those further developments sooner rather than later.
Sure thing.